I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Congress has a lot on its plate after the August recess, including votes on trillions of dollars in spending for social programs, climate policy, and infrastructure projects. They have to decide whether to increase the debt ceiling and whether to continue to fund the government or face a shutdown starting in October. While Republicans are largely on the same page about their opposition to Biden's economic agenda, there's a fight in the Democratic Party between progressives and moderates. Here's West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin on CNN's State of the Union on Sunday about why he will not vote for the proposed $3.5 trillion spending bill.
We've already put out $5.4 trillion, and we've tried to help Americans in every way we possibly can. And a lot of the help that we put out there is still there, and it's going to run clear until next year, 2022. What's the urgency? What's the urgency that we have? It's not the same urgency that we have with the American Rescue Plan. We got that out the door quickly. That was about $2 billion, $2 trillion. And on top of that, you know, all the things we've had with the CARES package, everything leading up to that. So we have done an awful lot, and there's still an awful lot of people that need help. But you have 11 million jobs that aren't filled right now. 8 million people are still unemployed. Something's not matching up.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders explained to CNN host Dana Bash about why he favors spending trillions of dollars on infrastructure projects and social programs.
Yeah, and that's my final question to you, because you know that a lot of your fellow progressives in the House are saying explicitly they will not vote for the infrastructure bill that's already passed the Senate.
And I agree with them. Donna, let me be clear. I think they're doing exactly the right thing because promises have been made. Agreements have been made. We want a physical infrastructure bill. We have to rebuild our roads and our bridges. That's important. Human infrastructure is more important. We cannot continue to have elderly people unable to hear, no teeth in their mouths, children who can't get decent childcare. We cannot afford not to deal with climate. We have got to do that in this unprecedented moment in American history. Two bills go together. At the end of the day, I believe we're going to pass them both.
Joining us is Jim Tankersley. He's White House correspondent for The New York Times, focusing on economic policy. And Jim, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
Happy to have you here. With 50-50 split in the U.S. Senate between the Democrats and people that vote with the Democrats, like Bernie Sanders, and 50 Republicans who are clearly opposed to this reconciliation package, how do the Democrats get Manchin and everybody on board?
It's a balancing act. It's very tricky, and they're trying to do a lot of things in not a lot of time with incredibly thin majorities. So the basic strategy that Democratic leadership seems to have is to start with sort of this shared idea that they want to expand government spending on a whole bunch of areas that they think are important, whether it's help for child care, health care, home care, climate change, education. It's a bill packed with things that Democrats have been campaigning on for a long time and funded in large part by tax increases that a lot of Democrats have run on for a long time. So those basic philosophies, I think, unify almost everyone within the Democratic caucus. And now they are trying to kind of smooth the details such that they can find, you know, a full agreement with everyone.
Is Manchin correct in that there is still money that was signed off by Congress last year for the pandemic still sloshing around the system and not been put to work yet?
Well, yes, yeah, sloshing around is I mean, I guess that's true. But I would say there's just money that hasn't been able to make it out the door yet. So, for example, the aid to renters who are potentially facing eviction this fall has been very slow to come out through the Treasury Department and through state and local governments. And then state and local governments have huge amounts of money that they were given as aid that they have not entirely spent yet either. So Joe Manchin is right. But also, I think we're talking about two very different things. As much as Democrats might occasionally conflate the current economic crisis with the longer term structural changes President Biden wants to make with the economy, they're very different. And the bill that's being considered in the House and the Senate right now is not really about the immediate crisis. It's not about helping people who have been suffering from the pandemic. That was what the $1.9 trillion bill they passed in the spring was for.
So looking ahead, this money is really to what? Reshape the economy to help middle class Americans, maybe even working class Americans, who I think many people feel, and certainly President Biden feels, have been left out of, you know, any kind of economic recovery, even predating the pandemic.
Yeah, there's, I mean, this bill does a lot. It's trying to do a wide range of things, but you can kind of very loosely group them mostly under the heading of trying to ramp up the federal government's role in the economy in order to better support working families. So that includes universal pre-kindergarten to help more kids have educational opportunities to go on to middle class jobs maybe in the future. It includes 2 years of free community college. It includes, like I said, support for childcare, paid leave programs. All of these are sort of a way of building skills for people so that they can earn more money, and giving workers more ability to have flexibility to work more. So if you're a parent in particular, if you have affordable childcare, you can maybe work more hours. This is the sort of broader economic theory, but then there's also like an entire section on climate change, which the White House sees as crucial to winning advanced industries in the future. And there's immigration components and a bunch of other stuff. So it is a complete overhaul of the federal government's role in the economy and the country.
I don't want to have you speak for Senator Manchin, but he represents a very poor state, West Virginia. And just all the things that you ticked off about childcare and pre-K and family leave and, you know, free community college. I mean, wouldn't that be a boon for a state like West Virginia?
I mean, I think that you certainly can make the case that there are a lot of people in West Virginia and a lot of other states like it who would benefit from these spending programs. Senator Manchin has been clear that he has some design issues, though, with some of the ways people would benefit. One of the big ones is the child tax credit. So the bill would give a lot of money. I think it's like $500 billion over the course through 2025 to parents, including direct payment, continuing direct payments to very low income or people who don't have any income at all, parents. That is a way, Democrats have Cassa says, a way to fight child poverty. But Joe Manchin wants to have a work requirement tacked onto that because he sees that as important for his state and his constituents. That's a big split in how that money would be allocated if it is and how the program would work. And it reflects, I think, the difference between how Joe Manchin sees the needs of his state and maybe how other Democrats do.
We hear Senator Bernie Sanders saying, yeah, we're going to be able to pass this thing. He has at least publicly a fair degree of optimism that this is going to pass. Is he on thin ice, Jim, do you think? Or is there something that he knows that maybe we don't know?
I mean, anybody trying to pass a piece of legislation this large with the majorities as small as they are that Democrats have would be on thin ice. But I would say Senator Sanders has shown a real pragmatism here in crafting this bill. He has been incredibly strident for pushing for the progressive parts of this bill, trying to make it as big as possible that he wants. But he has made a lot of compromises already on things that he cares about in hopes of keeping the caucus together. Now, whether that's enough is going to probably depend a lot on Democratic leadership, Chuck Schumer in the Senate, Nancy Pelosi in the House, and of course, most of all, on the president to try to bring together the very ideological, diffuse wings of the party. So it's tough. It's tough for everybody, but I think there's a real chance they could pull this off because they see this as their only shot to do a lot of these things.
A couple of other items that are on the table, one having to do with increasing the debt ceiling. Do you anticipate a fight there, Jim?
Well, it's tricky because the the debt ceiling was, if you recall, during the Obama years, a constant political battle. Republicans pushed for budget cuts to make it happen, and Democrats kept warning, like, we're not going to go over this cliff and default on our debts, which would be a very bad thing for the economy and for the credit rating of the government. On the flip side, President Trump came in and Republicans voted to suspend the debt limit very easily. Now, Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, is saying, look, we're not going to do this. Democrats can do this on their own and we expect them to do it. And so it's going to be a game of chicken, I think. Democrats don't want to put this in their reconciliation bill. They want Republicans to agree to do it as part of their regular bill in the House and the Senate. And if they don't, then I guess we have to see who blinks first. It's every time that this has happened in the past, at the very end of the day, Congress has raised the debt limit or suspended it. It would be strange to think that it would be different this time, but it is a weird political moment, and I wouldn't count it out.
Well, let me add something else about a potential government shutdown. What's the read on that, Jim?
I think people that I talk to, both within the administration and on Capitol Hill, are less worried about a government shutdown, which, again, Congress has sort of learned doesn't ever end well for anybody. The party in power, the party out of power, voters just don't like it. That seems to be less of a concern right now than raising the debt limit, which would have immediate and catastrophic economic consequences, economists warn. So I think that that is, frankly, I think that it's possible that the funding the government could come down to the very last minute, as it always seems to, and we could end up with a couple of extensions. And Congress is very much like a teenager with their homework on this. but the debt limit is the one that's scaring more people.
Well, let me throw something else on the table, which is how to pay for this. And it looks like that the Democrats are looking to corporations and to very wealthy people to foot the bill. Help us understand that piece of this agenda.
Yeah, absolutely. So the president has said consistently he wants this big spending bill to be paid for, offset by largely by increased tax revenues. That they have some spending cuts, which come from trying to save the money the government spends on prescription drugs. But there's like $2 trillion that Democrats have proposed in tax increases on high earners and corporations. Some of it is stuff you've heard about for a long time. Rolling back some of President Trump's tax cuts to raise the corporate tax rate, for example, or to raise the highest marginal income tax rate on really high earners. But other things are new, including new efforts to tax multinational companies that operate overseas, and in particular, a new surcharge the House just tossed out to raise money by charging even more income tax on people who earn $5 million or more.
And I was reading that the Treasury Department, I guess the IRS, wants to beef up enforcement. Jim, we're almost out of time here, but enforcement to make sure that people who owe their federal taxes are paying it. Can that help to defray some of these costs?
Yeah, there's the CBO's said that could raise $200 billion, maybe more, over the course of a decade. So, yeah, the administration really thinks that this is an important part of its tax component, getting sort of tax-dodging corporations and high earners to pay what they owe, and they want to invest heavily in the IRS to do that.
And it's going to be busy, what, couple of weeks looking ahead?
Weeks, months. I mean, the president has said he'd like to sign this next month. Democrats are, you know, there's a lot of deadlines coming up, and deadlines tend to be forcing mechanisms in Washington. But I think, yeah, the next few weeks are going to be a pretty sprint pace, and that we could very much see something come together or fail entirely by, you know, midfall.
Well, stay tuned. And as always, Jim Tankersley, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. He's White House correspondent for the New York Times, focusing on economic policy. We've got two guests waiting in the wings, and we will carry on this conversation after this very short break, taking a larger look at the U.S. economy hit hard by the pandemic. What's ahead? Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We just said goodbye to the New York Times' Jim Tankersley about the budget battles in Congress over trillions of dollars in spending. The U.S. Census Bureau just released data that 8.5 million people were lifted out of poverty in 2020, a significant drop due to the stimulus payments because of the COVID-caused economic crisis. Those jobless benefits, though, have largely expired. The very wealthy did just fine during the pandemic, helped by the stock market and tax policies. Today, there are millions of job openings and millions of Americans who are out of work and looking for employment. What explains this mismatch? And while things are better than a year ago, the Delta variant, uncertainty about schools staying open, the unvaccinated filling ICUs, and concerns about inflation are worrying signs. But do we want to return to business as usual, or is the pandemic reshaping the U.S. and global economies. Joining us, Heather Long, economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Heather, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And Mark Zandi is with us as well, chief economist at Moody's Analytics. And Mark, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty. Good to be with you and good to be on with Heather.
Absolutely. We're happy to have both of you. And I want to make sure our listeners can join us as well. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Any questions or comments? You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Mark, let me just toss something at you related on what Jim Tankersley was talking about in the first segment of the show. Just looking at the trillions of dollars that the government spent largely last year, but still, you know, being spent this year by individuals and by companies. How much did that, in a sense, save the U.S. economy?
Huge. That was key, critical to allowing the economy to navigate through the pandemic as reasonably gracefully as it did. Obviously, a lot of pain and suffering despite all the support, but without it, the economy would have been completely crushed. So very, very important. The numbers are large. I mean, if you tote it all up, it's a little over $5 trillion in support, everything from unemployment insurance and stimulus checks to money for small businesses, the airlines, a long list of things. And just for context, that's 25% of GDP. That's the value of all the things that we produce. If you go back to the financial crisis, which I thought was a doozy of a downturn, all the support provided by the federal government then was about 10% of GDP. So oh, wow. Massive amount of support, but critical, absolutely critical to help the economy to get through.
Heather, let me pick up on something, in fact, you wrote about in the Washington Post about the impact of all the spending on the poverty rate in this country. And it's pretty extraordinary. And I just want to have you flesh that out for us.
It really is. With all those payments that Mark was just talking about, the $5 trillion, poverty actually fell last year to a record low, 9.1%. Obviously, that's still millions of people in poverty in this country, and we can't shy away from talking about that and thinking about that. But the reality is poverty would have risen and been probably quite dramatically without these payments. I think in particular, what two quick takeaways that I had that really made my jaw drop looking at this data yesterday. The first is the one action the government took that had the biggest impact on keeping people out of poverty, keeping people fed, keeping people in their homes, were the stimulus checks, those $1,200 checks that went out shortly after the pandemic started. They went out to you know, the vast majority of Americans, including retirees. And that was just the program that really made the biggest difference. Close to 12 million people kept out of poverty because of that program. And the second thing that really floored me is when you look down the list, every single age group, every single race and ethnic group, and every single type of education level. So even folks who don't have college degrees, who've struggled for years, saw a big reduction in poverty because of these programs. Of course, the big question is, can we keep this momentum going, or is this a one-time blip?
Well, let me pick up on that and actually go to the reconciliation package. I'll go back to you, Mark Zandi. We're talking about $3.5 trillion, including funding for child care, for pre-K, for paid family leave, for free community college, expansion of Medicare. I mean, if you give people money, then you can, you know, help keep them out of poverty. But is this an argument for more spending just to try to keep the economy and individuals, especially those sort of on the margins, in better financial economic shape?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that reconciliation bill, the $3.5 trillion, is more about long-term economic growth. It's about lifting the productivity of the workforce and getting people to work, raising labor force participation. So we'll have a bigger economy down the road, and of course, that should help benefit everyone. But more specifically, the different policies in the reconciliation bill are designed to ensure that the benefits of that stronger growth, of that bigger economy, go to lower income households, lower and middle income households. You know, that's everything from, you know, the economy.
Ooh, I think we lost Mark. We'll see if we can get him back. I believe he's on a Merlin. Okay, we're going to try to get him back. Heather, let me go back to you. And even just picking up on what Mark said about how this investment is really an investment in working class people, and it does, and working Americans, more middle class Americans, does raise questions about whether we're going to look more, if assuming this passes, look more like Europe than, you know, America of a decade ago.
That's certainly an interesting way to put it. In some ways, they think there's hope within the Biden administration and within Congress to move a little bit more towards the European system. And by that, I mean, look, a big goal of investing all of this money in what they're calling the care economy, you know, so lots of money for, say, universal child preschool for 3 and 4 year olds, and for having finally in the United States paid parental leave. You know, the goal of these programs is partly to get more parents working, particularly women, moms. And one of the shocking truths is the United States in the 80s and early 90s led the world in women participating in, you know, paid work outside the home. Unfortunately, we are no longer the leader. Not only are we no longer the leader, we have fallen dramatically below not just many European countries, but Canada and even Japan, which for many a long time was seen as, you know, very at the bottom in having women participate in the economy. And now we are below Japan. And so, you know, I think a big part of the thinking here is not only, you know, how can we improve growth and create more jobs and maybe raise pay, but it's really how can we fully utilize the talent in this country, particularly among women.
But do you think, Heather, that is because of the kinds of jobs that women have been doing and the pay associated with that? I'm thinking of people that work in the fast food industry. They have almost no control over their week-to-week schedule, the way those jobs are run. Are these the kinds of jobs you're talking about?
For a long time, we know that women get paid generally much less than men, particularly women of color. And you're right that to focus on the fast food industry, but where this bill could really make a potential difference is actually in the care sector. So home health aides, child care workers, these are jobs that still in many cases pay under $15 an hour. So daycare workers and after school aides typically make $12 an hour. And I've certainly spoken to many who make less than that. And so the idea would be to try to lift the women up who are working in those fields and hopefully encourage them to get more training. When you think about who do you want watching children and helping educate children, you know, these workers also want to go back to school. They want to have more advanced certifications. They want this to be, you know, the best experience that it can be for the kids as well as for the workers. And right now, the system is not doing that.
Well, let me go back to you, Mark Zanni. I believe we have you back with us on Radio Times. But it seems to me that if people were paying attention, they saw during the pandemic that there were frontline essential workers. Now, some of them were you know, people in relatively well-paid jobs like doctors, but there were enough people that were you know, working on the front lines in grocery stores or doing deliveries, or they were custodians. Do you think there's a greater appreciation for these workers and a support for better pay, better benefits, better control over their work lives?
I cut out there. I was just about ready to get to the meaning of life, Marty. So
no, there you go. We're always ready for that one. But no, go ahead, Mark.
I think there's certainly an appreciation that frontline workers really were critical to, you know, helping us, you know, get through this very dark and painful period. But I think at the end of the day, it's just, you know, whether they get more pay or not depends on just raw economics. I mean, our memories will fade here pretty quickly. But I think fortunately, it appears that given for demographic reasons and a number of other reasons that labor is going to have the upper hand here in negotiations with employers, and that, you know, labor markets are going to be tight, particularly for the kinds of workers that work in these kind of essential jobs. And that I do expect wage growth. It has been strong, since the pandemic hit, and I expect it to remain strong going forward, just because of the supply and demand for these types of workers going forward, and the fact that they're going to be in strong demand and the supply is going to be restrained.
And that's Mark Zandi. He's chief economist for Moody's Analytics. Heather Long is with us as well, economics correspondent for The Washington Post. I do want to get to some comments here, but first, Heather, I want to pick up on something that you wrote about that's getting a lot of attention, something like 10 million job openings in this country and 8.5 million people who are looking for work. What does explain this mismatch? What's going on?
Yeah, obviously your first instinct is to think, okay, if we have over 10 million job openings, it's near 11 million, we just learned from the summer, and 8.4 million unemployed, then why can't we get more of these unemployed people back to work? I'll just say a couple quick points. Obviously, we're still in a pandemic, and with that Delta variant surge, there was a lot of hesitation and in some cases an inability to get back to work as schools and daycares were struggling to reopen or forced to go back into some quarantine modes. But beyond that, I think there's a couple of key points to remember. And one of the first ones is where those job openings are located physically and the industries and sectors they're in are not necessarily where the unemployed people are located and the skills and the background and resumes that they have experience in the industries they used to work in. So that's a key mismatch that I think often gets overlooked. Another key point is a lot of the unemployed right now, over 3 million, have been unemployed a long time. So over 6 months, in some cases a year, if somebody lost a job in that first March or April of 2020, they've been out of work for over a year now. And we know from history tells us that those people tend to struggle a lot more to get back into the workforce. And a key reason is there was a great Harvard Business School study that just came out on this. A lot of major employers use robots and artificial intelligence to scan all those resumes that are submitted on sites like Indeed or LinkedIn. And unfortunately, a lot of those AI programs skip over people who have gaps in their resume. Again, it seems so simple. Let's get all these people hired. But actually, you hear from both employers, I can't find the people I want. And when you talk to a lot of employed, they say, I send out resumes for hours a day and never get a call. So we clearly have a number of issues going on here matching people up.
Now, Mark, you want to speak to that? And I mean, we've all seen signs on restaurants or businesses saying, there might be a delay because we have a worker shortage. How do we address this?
Yeah, I think it's the pandemic. I think this spring and early summer when the vaccines got rolled out, we got going here pretty quickly. It seemed like every business in the country put up a help wanted sign at the same time. So there's a surge in demand with the reopening of the economy. And then the supply of workers, that is taking a bit longer to kind of kick into gear for, some of the mismatching reasons, but I think more fundamentally it's just the pandemic. I mean, parents have had to stay home to take care of kids. Maybe that will abate now that schools are reopened in person. A lot of people are staying home taking care of parents, elderly parents. They're sick themselves. They're taking care of sick people. They lost jobs during the pandemic permanently. Their employer failed. A lot of businesses just failed during the pandemic. So they have to find a new job, a new employer. And, that doesn't happen in a week or two or a month or two. That takes a bit of time. So, there's a long list of reasons here, why it's just taking a bit of time for people to get back in their seats. But I think they will. And over the course of the next few months, certainly by this time next year, these labor supply issues will start to abate. But having said all of that, the mismatching issues that Heather brought up are, serious ones. And, I think they'll play a role going forward. But I think as the pandemic winds down, we'll get back to work and these labor shortages will abate.
Well, speaking of the pandemic, I'm thinking of, vaccine mandates, mask mandates, what the president said last week about workplaces. And Heather Long, I mean, we think of COVID and these mandates as a public health issue, but it really is turning out to be as equally a powerful economic issue in terms of, who can open up. And when you look at red states and blue states, you do see some differences on both of those fronts.
Definitely. Obviously, economists, including Mark, have been screaming at the top of their lungs that the recovery, the economic recovery at least, depends hugely on getting the virus under control and getting most of the population vaccinated. It's the key to the health crisis and to the economic crisis. And we've seen a lot of encouraging signs, but if you just look at what happened as that Delta variant picked up and so many unvaccinated ended up in the hospital again, with coronavirus cases, you could see the economic effects. Hiring slowed sharply in August. There were job losses in restaurants in August. We saw some spending pullback, fewer people flying, fewer hotel bookings. So, and a huge, what the really, really concerning one in my mind, curious what Mark says, but was there was a huge drop in consumer confidence. We always talk about so much of the U.S. economy depends on spending. People going out and buying things, and the confidence just plunged in August as the sense of hopelessness really kind of took over. You know, people thought, I know I was one of them, you know, you sort of thought by September schools will reopen, maybe I'll be back in the office and things will just be close to normal. And instead it just hasn't panned out that way. And I think people are just very concerned and unfortunately nobody really has. I keep calling it the I don't know economy. You just don't know if those holiday toys are going to make it in time for the holidays spending. You don't know if the school is actually going to be open next week or you'll be quarantining. You don't know when a lot of these downtown urban areas are finally going to revive and see a lot of office workers back.
Well, I'm going to ask Mark Zandi after this very short break, but let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Heather Long, economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Mark Zandi is chief economist for Moody's Analytics. We're talking about many things related to the economy, frankly, how that pandemic is reshaping, at least temporarily, maybe permanently, parts of the U.S. economy. And we want to hear from you. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Mark Zandi and Heather Long about the economy. Mark, picking up on what Heather was saying right before the break about the level of kind of uncertainty, maybe anxiety among consumers, the I don't know economy. I saw flashed on my screen here a Pew study finding that 54% of adults feel that the worst is yet to come related to COVID and obviously the economy. How does this affect an overall economy when people either don't know or just don't feel good about it?
Yeah, I like that. I don't know economy. That's a good apt description of, I think, the general collective psyche. Yeah, and I think Heather is dead on. I mean, I was the same way. I thought when those vaccines got rolled out that, okay, this is it. You know, we're going to put the pandemic, in a box and, life will get back to normal. We'll get going here. And then the Delta variant, upended all of that. I mean, it just, makes it very clear that this pandemic's not going anywhere and that's going to be an issue. Now, I do think the most likely scenario is that there will probably be more waves of infections, logic would dictate, but that with each wave we get better at adjusting to it, adapting to it, it does less economic damage. But, it has made people very nervous. It's very unnerving. And it's having an impact. The Delta virus has slowed the economy. It's changed the growth rates that we were experiencing, slowed things down. Now, hopefully it rolls over here and we start to rev right back up again. And I think that'll be the case. But how people think about things, how uncertain they are, how nervous or worried they are has a big impact on, their economic lives and the broader economy. So we need to put this pandemic in that box.
Let me put a couple of questions out there. One from Kurt, and I'll put this to you, Heather. How does inflation factor into the stimulus packages from the federal government? We're talking about, what, $3.5 trillion, maybe another trillion for infrastructure, and the $5 trillion already spent. Is there concern about inflation?
Yes, to be brief okay. about it. Look, anytime you're injecting a lot of money into the economy, you know, there is a chance that you will see inflation. And we'd actually just got an update on inflation this week, just a day or so ago. And we learned that while it cooled a little bit in August, it's still very close to the 13-year high, so 5.3% over last year. But I would say a couple of debates here, and you know, Mark certainly can chime in some more, but some key points in my mind are, first of all, a lot of it will depend on whether this spending is accompanied by tax increases. So while government spending would boost the economy, some of those tax hikes would put a little bit of brakes on that boost, and so that would help to contain inflation. And so at the moment, there are a lot of tax increases proposed, particularly on the rich and some large corporations. Whether those stick around, we'll see. And the second thing I would point out is a lot of the inflation right now is really being driven by these supply constraints. So a lot of us have been talking about the sticker shock when you go and look at a new or especially a used car, or when you try to buy a washing machine or a dishwasher or any sort of home-related items. And so, you know, this bill doesn't really help or hurt you know, what's going on with those supply chain issues, which are kind of a separate beast, if you will.
Well, Mark, let me toss a question from Mike and give you a chance to respond to what Heather said and also what Mike says. He says, how do you grow the economy by raising taxes, which means corporations will need to raise prices? I think tax hikes will just hurt the economy. Give us your thoughts about what this all means.
Well, tax hikes by themselves, all else being equal, a negative for the economy. But, you know, those tax increases are going to go to help finance, to pay for all of the other benefits that are being talked about here: health care, housing, child care, elder care, education, you know, if public infrastructure, things that climate change, you know, things that we need to be able to grow the economy more quickly. And I would point out that the tax increases that we're talking about here, these are taxes on large multinational corporations, the Moody's Corporation, my employer, or the well-to-do, people who have very high incomes and very, very wealthy. And so the impact of those higher tax rates is relatively small. So you can get a sense of that by going back to the Trump tax cuts, right, which is what we're talking about here. We're basically rolling back a chunk of those tax cuts. And there's been a number of different studies that have been done, the most recent coming out of the Brookings Institution, a think tank in Washington, that shows that the increase in economic activity resulting from those tax cuts is on the margin at best and hardly perceptible and hard to see. So that would argue that, well, okay, if we roll those back, then the negative consequences of that are going to be relatively small and certainly be swamped by the benefits of all the other things that are being done here: educating the population, you know, addressing climate change, you know, making it easier for people to go to work because their child care isn't too expensive, you know, finding a way to address the affordable housing shortage. I mean, one problem that many people are now facing is rapidly rising rents and house prices, making housing very unaffordable for many, many Americans, and this bill would address that. So I think the tax increases we're talking about here are they are not going to have significant negative consequences, and the benefits of where that money are quite substantial. Just one quick thing, Marty, on the inflation. Yeah, you know, the current inflation's up, no doubt about it, but that goes right to the pandemic. It has nothing to do with the policy debate that's going on in Washington. It's, you know, we reopened fast, so demand surged. And again, the supply side of the economy, labor, manufacturing activity, construction activity is just taking a bit longer to kind of kick into gear, and in large part because the pandemic is still on. I mean, you know, one of the biggest price increases have been for vehicles, and the reason for that is because the automakers can't produce cars mm-hmm. because they can't get chips, and that's because Malaysian chip plants are closed because everyone's sick. So, you know, it's about the pandemic, and, you know, the concerns about it, which all suggest that the inflationary pressures will start to abate. And, you know, I don't think we should be connecting the dots between the inflation we're certainly observing now and, you know, the kind of fiscal policy packages that are being debated in Washington now.
Heather, let me just pick up on something we talked about, what we, you know, hopefully learned from the pandemic and the fact that there were so many low-income workers who we called essential workers, but we also saw a lot of well-to-do people and people that could work from home and had money in the stock market did okay during or maybe even well during the pandemic. ProPublica did an expose looking at the very, 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 very wealthy people like Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, paying almost nothing in federal income tax. And I wonder whether in any way this can be addressed.
Well, that's certainly exactly what the president is saying, that these tax increases are needed. One of the ones Democrats proposed this week was what they're calling a surcharge on people who earn over $5 million a year. So that's specifically going towards this population that you're speaking of, the super rich who you know, have a lot more ways than most of the listeners on this radio program to keep their taxes low. You know, that's the argument. The argument is that the United States used to tax wealthy individuals at a much, much higher rate. As a matter of fact, for what's considered sort of the golden era of the U.S. economic growth in the sort of 50s, 60s, and 70s, you know, that the tax rate on the top earners was, you know, well over 50%. And, you know, at the moment, we're down around 30%. And so, obviously, you know, there's always debates about what the exact right number is. But I think historical evidence shows us that it can probably should be at least a little bit higher.
Here's a question from Conrad Mark, who says, I keep hearing stories that people don't want to work because their unemployment benefits are so good. Is that a factor in people not going back to work?
No, I don't think, certainly not a significant factor. I mean, there's there's a long list of reasons why people have had difficulty getting back to work in a timely way here. And we talked about, you know, some of them, you know, parents taking care of kids and elderly parents, the people that taking care of, you know, sick family members and on and on and on. And perhaps on that list is, you know, some of the benefits that are provided to unemployed workers, the so-called supplemental unemployment insurance. These are, you know, additional help through the unemployment insurance system for people who've been become unemployed because of the pandemic. And there was a lot of debate about this, you know, a couple of 3 months ago. But the evidence is now starting to come in, the data, the actual economic data. And there's no evidence in the data, at least as far as I can tell, that suggests that that this has been had a big impact. I'll just give you one piece of data. You know, half the states, mostly in the South and West, ended their supplemental UI, this extra payment through the unemployment system early. The other half of states, you know, continued on all the way through September. That's what economists call a natural experiment. So we can see what happened to the job market, people going back to work or not in these half of states where the supplemental UI ended early and the half of states where it didn't. And there is no difference between the two.
Wow.
So that suggests that, you know, no, we need to get more data, and, you know, economists will be debating this, you know, ad nauseum for you know, years and decades to come. That's what we do for a living. But at least so far, you know, the evidence suggests that this has not had an impact. And, you know, intuition says that it probably has. So, you know, I guess at some point we'll see something in the data, but so far not.
Heather, here's a question from Beverly. She says it's wonderful that the 2020 economic impact payments lifted so many out of poverty, but why did a family which makes nearly $150,000 need a monthly payment of $3,600 for children under 6 and $3,000 for children 6 to 17, which they've chosen to have? The next bill needs to be more targeted. She's saying, why was it so, from her perspective, so overly generous?
Yeah, that's certainly the argument that West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, this sort of key Democratic swing voter, is making, that he would like to see a smaller package that's about half the size or of the $3.5 trillion and more targeted, just like what Beverly is saying. So this is a very live debate. I will say specifically on the child tax credit, it's important to remember that prior to what was done during the pandemic and this year, the child tax credit was up to about $2,000 per family. So yes, there it has been enhanced, but I think people forget it's not like the $3,000, you know, is totally new, that those middle class families could access up to $2,000 before this.
Mark, let me put a couple of other things on the table before we have to say goodbye. There's, there will be a debate and vote in Congress about whether to raise the debt limit, which I read a quote from you saying that if we don't, it would be, quote unquote, financial Armageddon. Expand on that.
Yeah, this is a big deal. I mean, you know, no one seems to be focused on it because we've been down. We all think we've seen this movie before, where we've come up to this so-called debt limit, and at the 12th hour, Congress and the president come together, sign a piece of legislation, and either increase the debt limit or suspend it. And just for FYI, the debt limit is the amount of federal government debt that can be outstanding. And because we have the federal government runs a deficit, it, you know, needs to borrow money. We spend more than we take in revenue. That if you limit, put a limit on the debt, then at some point the Treasury Department, the guys who cut the checks, can't pay everyone, at least not in a timely way. So someone's not going to get paid, you know, sometime by the end of October, you know, according to Janet Yellen, the Secretary of the Treasury, you know, if that debt limit's not increased. You know, a bedrock of the American economy, and I would say of the global economy, the global financial system, is that the United States of America pays its debts. It pays it on time. You know, we established that principle back with Alexander Hamilton when he paid 100 cents on the dollar on the Revolutionary War bonds. And by so doing, he established the credit of the United States. It made it we are risk-free. If you were money good, if you give us your money, if you buy our bonds, if you buy our debt, you're going to get repaid. So if there's any question about that, then the whole bedrock framework for our system, you know, will shake. Global investors will say, hey, you got to pay me a lot more money because now you have politicized this process. I may not get paid on in a timely way. There's a lot of risk here. You're not risk-free. You're not money good. And so interest rates will rise, and we'll be paying for that for generations to come. Actually, very interesting. In 1979, we had a debt limit debate discussion. They signed on the dotted line at the 12th hour. They increased it, but the Treasury Department couldn't fix its computer programs fast enough, and so they didn't pay Treasury bills on time. It was a computer glitch. It wasn't intentional.
Oh my gosh.
They just and there's studies that show that that cost hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars over you know several decades because investors you know said, hey, if you can screw this up. You know, this is a problem for me. So, you know, this is how important this is. They have to get this done. And I actually think this is probably more of a risk than you know, people think it is at this point, just because of the politics of increasing the debt limit or suspending it.
Heather, I want to squeeze one more question, a comment in or give you a chance to respond because you wrote about the fact that we're also in a productivity boon. So what's that about in 40 seconds or less?
Well, we hope we're in a productivity boom. Certainly, the big surprise in this pandemic is it forced us all to do things differently. In some ways, that was a positive in the sense that we realized we don't have to spend so much time commuting or flying around the world. And many of us finally learned, and I'll raise my hand and say, to embrace technology even more, ordering things like groceries or whatnot, that we didn't have to spend as much time going out and about. And so you put all that together and it's actually made workers even more productive. And that's actually a really great thing. It's one of the key drivers of the economy's long-term growth and potential.
Well, my thanks to both of you, Heather Long and Mark Zandi, for joining us today on Radio Times. We covered a lot of territory. Heather, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Mark Zandi, thank you very much as well.
Thanks, Marty. It was great to be with you.
Nice to have you both with us. And he is chief economist for Moody's Analytics. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. You can find out much more about the program. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.